Hi, everybody. It's Ryan. Before we start this episode, I just wanted to throw out a disclaimer that if there's any awkward pauses or glaring lack of Brendan, I don't want to lie to you. I respect your intelligence. A lie might be funny, but the truth, the reality of the situation might be even funnier, quite frankly. Brendan spilled a burrito on his computer, and he lost everything. So he's gonna be gone for a little bit. He wasn't gone from the recording, but his recordings are gone from his computer. So that explains it. Sorry about that. It's gonna be a couple of short ones. I think it's just gonna be all of this episode and maybe half of the next one. So we apologize. Brendan, most of all, he lost the most out of all of this. So anyway, cheers. Enjoy the episode.
And for those reasons, my vote is going to have to go to Pan's Labyrinth this week.
Ryan!
It's not going to sync well. It's not going to sync well. I'm not going to participate.
It would have synced.
I thought about it. It would have synced. I'm not going to.
It's the Kino Clash intro music. We do it every week. It's been a staple of the podcast since day one.
Yeah, I wanted to join in, but like it would not be in time. And it would just sound
well, then
terrible,
we would have had a beautiful cacophony. Anyway, intro music concluded. Welcome to Kino Clash, the podcast where I lose a lot. This week, we've got my number 7 pick, The Aviator, up against Alex's number 10 pick, Pan's Labyrinth. And I'll tell you what, I'm probably gonna lose.
I don't know. I don't think so.
I'm gonna lose. It's okay. But anyway, Alex, take it away.
Wait, who else is here,
right,
though? Besides Alex.
Actually,
doesn't fucking matter. You two dregs don't matter. Oh, whose else is here? It's people who have movies and others. That's all.
Ryan from Kino Clash is here.
All right.
Cool.
I'm Alex, and I will be reading the description. So today's episode is Pan's Labyrinth, and IMDb's description is... In the phalangist Spain of 1944, the bookish young stepdaughter of a sadistic army officer escapes into an eerie but captivating fantasy world.
Really went kind of crazy with the adjectives in that one.
I like that name. I like bookish as a descriptor.
Yeah.
I mean, it fits.
I don't know what phalangist means.
Well, phalanges are fingers, are they not?
Yes, but so this maybe... is relating to or characteristic of the Spanish phalange movement. Phalange movement.
Oh.
Okay. I guess that's a history thing. Kyle, what is the phalange movement?
If I had to take a guess, I'm going to say communist versus fascist, 30s Spain.
That's a good guess.
Guernica, anyone? I was reflecting, just before we get into it, I think the Spanish Civil War is the most talked about, not talked about historical event. Like, it comes up more often than I'd expect, but it's still not very prevalent in anyone's mind.
This is the one and only medium that I've ever learned about the Spanish Civil War.
Mm. I can kick us off, I guess, into opening thoughts. I love this movie. This is, I think, my third time I've seen it, and I think each time I watch it, I have a new appreciation for it. I always forget how much I love it. And it always blows me away. It really just dips you into this fantastical, magical experience. And there's a lot of these dark, scary elements to it. And it just really feels like you're watching a storybook come to life. And a lot of that is emphasized with the camera work and a lot of the shots. There's a lot of particles floating through the lighted forest and everything. It's a very magical experience, and I have a good time watching it every time. It's just exceptionally well made and well acted, and the score is beautiful and melancholy and dark and fantastical. So I'll leave it there for now, but this is a delight to watch.
Suppose it's my turn then. I'll sound off on the effects. Del Toro is so good at just physical effects, and not just littering his movies with CGI, and it's so refreshing. Even though I also think he reuses these costumes in every movie and just makes a few little alterations to them.
And reuses Doug Jones. In every single movie.
It's just one of those, like, hey, you know what? Power to you. You made a good costume. I'll give you credit for that. So that being said, the not spectacle necessarily, but the physical presentation in all his movies is always just like, it transports me to the world he's trying to make. Flip side of that coin, his movies just never really speak to me that much. I would never call one bad, but like, it's normally just things that I'm like, oh, this was a fun watch, but never really gonna think too much on it.
You were a big fan of Shape of Water, though, right?
I like Shape of Water the same way I like this movie, where it's like, oh, that's really cool, but like, you know, I don't particularly care about it, I would say. I like the Hellboy movies a lot. Those are some of my favorites. But yeah, no, overall, a very enjoyable watch, but nothing that grips me, nothing that really gets me at any point.
Yeah, well then I'll just echo everything Ryan said, because I absolutely love this movie. and like what Kyle was saying, he's a master of his craft in practical effects and costuming and makeup, that I just want every movie to look like his movies, because it feels so real. And honestly, the reality of it versus using CGI makes it feel more fantastical and magical, because it feels more like, if I experienced this in real life, I would be also in awe, because it feels so real. It feels so practical and tactile, that it almost breaks your sense of reality, because it doesn't exist in reality. I love the score. The score makes you feel so many different emotions throughout this whole movie. It's beautiful. It comforts you. It's nostalgic, but it's also tragic, and it makes you feel like the innocence of Ophelia in this movie and the darkness of this world. It's just such a robust score, and I love listening to it. The world is so lived in. The actors are so good at playing these characters. It's just such a nice... Everything it does in this movie is so well done, and the world that he builds here, and the story he tells is just... I really haven't ever experienced like this pool of emotions in really any other movie. But yeah, I love this movie so much.
Yeah, it was a good pick. I'm glad it was on your list, because it's one that I don't revisit too often, but every time I do, it blows me away every time. It's really great.
And just like Kyle was saying, normally Del Toro's movies don't really speak to me either. I was not a fan of The Shape of Water. I thought it was really weird, and I didn't really like much about it.
I'll agree there. It was weird.
What was weird? I haven't seen Hellboy in years. That. Five words or less.
Fishman, she was deaf. Woman.
It's not even accurate. It's not even an accurate claim.
I haven't seen Hellboy in years, so I really don't remember anything about it. But his movies always just seem a little more like, I think when the fame, when he got his fame and all the credits for his films, that he just kind of like super leaned into it for his movies. And I think they're visually stunning, but the stories don't really do anything for me. But I think this movie, I don't know if this is his first breakthrough movie, right?
No. What do you mean breakthrough?
Like, is this what kind of put him on the map and kind of got him some like Hollywood gigs and stuff?
No,
Hellboy came out before this.
Yeah, even back in the 90s, he had movies like Kronos, which that's another really good one. I like Pan's Labyrinth more. I think Pan's Labyrinth is my favorite of his. This is the one where it really, because all of his movies feel like, I don't know, like hand or not hand, like verbally presented works of fiction. Like it feels very much like a grandma or something telling you these stories. And I think the storybook nature of Pan's Labyrinth kind of lends itself best to that kind of idea. His other movies always have these fantastical elements, but this is the one where it truly feels like a fairy tale. A dark one at that. It really is. That's the Pale Man scene. That part, That's the part where it really leans furthest into a fairy tale kind of thing. Like, she's given the magic chalk and is able to make a door to that world, like, in her own room. Like, that just feels very much like something you would read in a storybook. In a weird way, it feels like the movie as a whole feels like a grown-up version of Goosebumps. Like, a lot of relatively simple, like, plot points, but they've been grown up quite a bit with the abrasive kind of nature of everything and how terrifying a lot of the creature designs and goo and whatnot is presented.
Yeah, and to that point, it's such an adult, dark, scary movie while still following the imagination and creativity of a little girl. And so, like, that dichotomy there of kind of this is the brutality of war and, like, contrasting with the innocence of this little girl's imagination also kind of adds, like, the heartbreaking nature of the ultimate ending and just her journey throughout of her mom passing away and this whole, and just having this awful new father. I think it really sells the emotion there, having that dichotomy there.
For sure. It's one of those things where you're, like, watching these fantastical things happen, and in a lot of movies those would be presented in a really silly or charming way, and in this movie it's presented the same way, but it totally buys into its own concepts. It never tries to stray away from those storytelling elements that would be totally unbelievable in real life, but the people in the world buy it, and that makes the audience buy it, and I think that's really effective. An example of that is when she's given the mandrake root and she has to put it in milk under her mom's bed, and the general ends up finding it, and he's like, what is this? Like, they still show that. Like, a lot of movies, I feel like they would show that and he, like, wouldn't understand what it was, or they'd, like, try to hide it or something like that. Every magical element is presented in a way that would exist in that world, and it just makes it a lot more believable and interesting to watch. It never feels silly because it buys its own concept.
Yeah, and along those lines, and, like, how just kind of, like, heartbreaking it is to see this childlike innocence in this world. At the end, when Mercedes, like, finally comes into the room after getting all the rebels in, and they took over the camp, and they're trying to find Ophelia in her room, and then she just kind of goes in the room, searches for her, the bed's empty, but she looks at the wall and sees the chalk cutout.
Mm-hmm.
Like, to her, I'm sure Mercedes is, like, this poor little girl just, like, is struggling to live in this new home with the worst father, and is still trying to make a life out of it and trying to be creative and have fun, knowing that, like, all her creativity and imagination is trying to be stifled by just everything that's going on. And so that part really, for some reason, this out of any of my other viewings, that part really stuck out to me, because I was like, oh man, that kind of hurts my heart.
Mm-hmm. That scar on his face is effective too, because at that point he's fully kind of, a scar is very telling in a movie, in any movie, and in this movie it's used so effectively, because you know by that point he's totally kind of unhinged. He doesn't really care anymore. Like, his wife is dead. That was the only thing really tying him to being a human. Now he's very unhinged, and he obviously doesn't care about the girl, only his son, so that made it scary.
Hey, and what about the doctor?
Yeah, you can see the regret.
I feel like in any other movie, it would have been a bigger bombastic reveal to the captain that, like, oh yeah, I've been working with the rebels. But here it was so silent and muted, just like, why didn't you obey me? And he goes, unlike you, captain, like, I don't obey without asking questions. And then just silently packs up his stuff and walks away. And, like, it just said everything he needed to say. And he was kind of, like, dignified in that, like, yeah, you know, I did what I could with the rebels, and fuck you, and I'm just going to walk off in peace and get shot in the back, and him just, like, taking off his glasses and then falling over. I loved it.
Yeah, that kind of silent bravery isn't shown too often. Like you said, a lot of times, sure, it's much more bombastic, so that was effective, especially for his character.
And something I didn't realize until just saying it now is, I don't know if this was intentional or not, but he kind of forced the captain to literally shoot him in the back, and that's kind of, you know, that seems like a cowardice move instead of doing it face-to-face. And so he kind of, like, put the captain in that position of weakness, even though he was about to go out. So I don't know if that's intended symbology there, but I'm a fan.
I would definitely think so. That was one of the things I took away. I gotta say, though, I definitely didn't get the same impact of any of these performances as y'all did. Like, nothing really struck out to me as y'all have been putting it. I don't know why that would be. I wasn't in like a bad mood or anything, but yeah, nothing really. I was like, this is good acting, but nothing reached out.
Yeah, I just thought everything they were trying to convey was conveyed in a lot of the facial expressions and delivery of lines. It's whenever that kind of thing happens and you're watching a story with such serious notes, you want to be able to say you bought every moment of it. And if you're not thinking about it, then that's kind of what that implies. So for me, it's just so effective. It's not like anything. Yeah, it's very muted, I guess would be a good word. It's not bombastic or anything. It's not these crazy yelling scenes or anything, save maybe the general probably has the most angry, vicious, like high-level acting performance. Like everything else is very subdued, and it just feels real and very grounded in this kind of magical world. So that's kind of why I like it so much.
And I was going to say, yeah, Michael Shannon's performance in Shape of Water and the general in this would be the two that really stick out to me more than anything else. Intentionally so.
But. And that said, the villain arc in this is set up so effectively because you can really tell just by how he's looking at Ophelia when they're getting out of the car after they first arrive, his kind of disdain and kind of apathy for her. Like the mother is clearly of value to him as a means to an end and getting an heir, I suppose. But every action after that point really just further characterizes him as a villain. And it's just so effective when they capture the two hunters and he kills them before searching the bag. It kills him brutally, mind you. And then also just how he interacts with people and kind of how he shows his power over people in every situation. It really makes you hate him effectively. It's so well done that you can't, like, it's so good to get his, you know, what he deserves at the end. It's such a good payoff after all that setup.
In the dinner scene when they have their guests over and someone asks her, the mom, Carmen, like, oh, how'd you guys meet? And she tells her story and he goes, please excuse my wife. She's not used to telling stories in front of guests and doesn't know that no one has any interest in anything she's saying. Like, that was so needlessly mean and just makes you want him to die so bad.
Yeah, he's a bit of a cold bastard.
One thing about the captain or just the villain in general that it's a very minor thing, but I really appreciate about this movie is how smart they made him. Like in really smart, small details, like how when he finds a little vial of antibiotics in the beginning of the movie and then later on in the doctor's bag, and how he has to go back to his office and compare them and actually get like true evidence, like, oh my God, like this kind of shows me like something's going on here. And then also, oh crap, what was the second thing I was going to say?
The key.
The key, yeah. He tells Mercedes to go out and get the liquor. And he goes, oh, well, you're forgetting the key here. Like, that's very smart. Any other movie could have been, like, they could have cut those little details out and been like, oh, he's catching on, and just kind of told you that, or just shown you, like, oh, he's catching on, but not really have any justification for it. But here, like, you kind of see him piecing together the puzzle with the evidence he has, and it felt just real. It felt like it added to the stakes of the doctor and Mercedes. You're like, oh, he truly is catching on, and, like, you're getting sloppy at what you're doing.
Yeah, and I think the kind of comparisons with him working on clock and clockwork and gears turning and everything, it really shows the meticulous nature of this guy. I think that's a really good visual cue, and it really just lends to that character being so well set up and executed throughout the movie.
I didn't pick up on that, but that has to be intentional. That's for sure the case, and like just how methodical he is with everything he does.
Yeah, purposeful. Like when he's shaving and everything, you can just tell the kind of, you know, point A to point B to point C to point D. He's always thinking about the next step, and it's always a very natural progression. He's clearly a very smart and cunning villain, and that's always going to be effective. A good villain is kind of key to a story like this.
Yeah.
That part where he takes a shot and it just pours through the slash in his cheek, that looked great. You just kind of get the pink hues going into the cotton. Yeah. We should talk about some of the... what's everybody's grossest moment? what got under people's... Pale Man?
it's getting the face bashed in for me.
Oh, when he's hitting him in the face with the bottle? Yeah.
That or the hand that was cut open from the...
Wait, what's the hand that was cut open?
When he took the prisoner? When the doctor comes in and mends to him, he like picks up his hand and his like index finger is just all the way over here because a giant gash between his index and middle. It's
disgusting. I did not pick up on that. Didn't catch it.
I like the moment when she's in the tree and she puts the rocks in the frog's mouth and this big mucousy mass of bugs and innards and goop and everything just starts pouring out of him and he becomes like a deflated puppet.
That part I think gross. That was probably my favorite part of the movie was her in the tree.
The bugs and everything and the slime. Yeah,
felt very magical.
I like the shot of her just kind of crawling through the tunnel. It feels very claustrophobic and dark. And that's just such a fairy tale task. Like, go and find the toad in the stump and feed him 3 magic stones. Like, that is absolutely just something that you would never think of for a story like this. But it works really well. And I don't know. Do you guys kind of how I interpret this movie? Which the things that literally happen in the movie, I think they're obviously trying to represent kind of how a child copes with trauma, how a child copes with new environments and things they're uncomfortable with. Because it's very clearly, because they could have, I guess, used someone older to portray Ophelia, but the kind of childlike wonder and intrigue and mystery for all of these tasks that she has to do work best with a child because it really shows that kind of imaginative nature that she has.
Yeah, for sure. And like how children try to always find a really crazy way of justifying just really natural things in life. For example, her mom's pregnancy and just having pregnancy complications. Her mind immediately goes to, oh, I need a magical mandrake in a bowl of milk with 2 drops of blood. That'll heal her. And because the captain got rid of it, that's why she ended up dying. When in reality, it's just, you know, that's life. Unfortunately, back then, her long travel when she shouldn't have traveled the pregnancy, that's just like the ultimate conclusion and her trying to cope with that and come up with an explanation for it.
So do you guys think that the fairy tale elements were just her imagination in this?
To some degree, but
at the end.
I mean, they in literally the labyrinth, happen. But
when the captain approaches her, the fawn isn't there in front of her when he sees her.
Well, I took that I think all the fairy tale elements are real. I take this as a fairy tale, not a child's imagination of it. Twofold on the fawn. One, I'm thinking Polar Express. Those who believe can see, but those who don't. That was my first thought. But the second that I saw when I was looking up some stuff after was someone made an argument that because he was high out of his mind on the sleeping pills that he, you know, might have just cast it away.
Yeah.
I'm really in the middle. What I love about this movie is that when the fantasy and the reality come together at moments, it's always presented in a way where it could go either way. Like when he finds the mandrake on the bed, it could very well still be a fantastical magical mandrake, but they see it as just a normal like root that gets thrown away, or you justifying with the drug trip and not seeing the fawn there. Because clearly her magical journey had real world repercussions with her drawing chalk on the walls and everything. And somehow she got keys to get into these rooms. So, there has to be an explanation there. So I love how like it really could go either way, whether this stuff was real or not.
Yeah. And that's really why I love this movie. I love a lot of movies that give you literal things that happen that represent ideas. I think this is one of them. I think for the sake of the story, these things literally happen to her, but they pretty clearly represent how children kind of cope with things like that. So it's any movie where you can take meaning just beyond what's given to you, I think is something worth talking about. This obviously being one of them for that and countless other reasons. It's really a great experience. This is such a complete package for me. This has been one of my favorite ones we've watched. And I had seen it before, but yeah, it's just really rewatchable because it had so many great filmmaking elements on top of a very smart story. I think it's told really well, and the presentation is great.
Everything fits just right. And for all Del Toro's work, for that matter, there's really nothing that ever sticks out.
So one thing I wanted to talk about was other movies that came out in 2006. What a year.
We got some heavy hitters. We got a lot of them on this list, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, I took a screenshot of like the most nominated Oscar things just as a reference. And as far as the ones I've seen, like we have Babel, Pan's Labyrinth, The Departed, Little Miss Sunshine, Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest, Apocalypto, Children of Men, which is one of mine. We got Cars. We got Flags of Our Fathers, The Prestige. Like, and that's one of Kyle's. Like, three of our picks are from this year. Yeah, what a year. And that must have been a difficult choice, like, because this is the year that the Oscars Academy probably had an actual decision to make. They didn't pick a bunch of boring movies out of a hat. Doesn't it? What'd you say?
I think Departed
got this picture. I said The Departed.
Yeah, so, no, I was... Okay.
Yeah, it was a good year. Unlike this year. I think this year's a little underwhelming.
Oh, yeah.
Like many years.
I mean, we were 3 years. What'd you say?
I feel like the last, like, 3 years have been kind of underwhelming.
Oh, no. No, the last 2 years have been some heavy hitters. 2019, well, we had Parasite.
Yeah, the 2019...
But that's, like, a clear winner.
2019 had Parasite, Joker, 1917, Uncut Gems. 2019 was Jojo Rabbit. 2019 was great.
It had a lot of good ones.
No, I loved the 2020 picks last year to just fully go off the rails. But,
I just thought it was cool, especially because three quarters of us have representatives from that year in our lists. I thought that was interesting.
Well, so I have only really one last thing to say about the movie before we move into final thoughts. And more than ever in this last viewing, what stuck out to me was the sound design in this movie.
Yeah. I'll give you that. Yeah.
Everything was so crunchy and squishy and gross. Like, anytime, obviously, people were, like, beaten or tortured. But also, like, the captain, you hear every ripple of his rubber and leather equipment every time he makes a slight twitch in his body. And I think, oh, man, it, like, gave me, like, goosebumps, kind of like ASMR-ish. Yeah. And also just kind of added to, like, the he's so official and means business. And just, like, anytime he steps into the room, you hear the boots on the cobblestone and everything. The fawn, every time he moves.
I was going to say, for
just,
me,
like,
it's the fawn.
Twigs
everything,
and wood.
Like...
Yeah. Oh my god, the sound design is impeccable in this movie. It's so perfectly done.
Yeah. Even down to like the fairy flying around and like you said the fawn like hitting its hooves on the stone. Like just very bassy stark noises. They did a great job with the sound design. That's something that I think goes underappreciated in a lot of movies is how effective good sound design can be. And yeah, it's out of this world in this movie. It's great. Not to get back to the Oscars, but that is a funny thing. It seems like a lot of their picks are what has the most of that category. Like, what has the most edits? Oh, Bohemian Rhapsody. What has the most sound? Don't Look Up had a lot of edits. Must have been good.
You could argue sound design and CGI should be the least noticeable thing, because if you notice it, then it's not well done, right?
Yeah. And unless you, like, notice it as, like, oh, that's awesome. Like, there are some examples, like, in this where it's great, but...
Yeah, but I'm talking more, like, I don't know what the winner of this year was, but, like, a movie like Blade Runner 2049 versus, like, a Marvel movie where the CGI are both super well done, but 2049, the CGI is invisible. It's just part of the world versus Marvel. It's just, like, here's 1,000 hours of render hours. But to this movie's credit, the sound design was amazing. And I mean, if you look for it, if you're noticing it, then you notice how great it is. But I think if you're just kind of experiencing the movie as it is, it just becomes cohesive with the world and it just sucks you in harder. Don't take that out of credit. Okay. Out of context. So far, I have Tight Little Package and Sucks You In Harder.
These are both NFTs, by the way, people. Both NFTs. You can own the rights to.
I was editing episode 10, and you talked about Marcellus Wallace getting his soul sucked out of his neck, and Brendan's like, I thought it got sucked out of somewhere else because he was sick. It's so funny. Oh, goodness.
All final right. thoughts?
Yeah, I reckon. Yeah, I guess I'll go into final thoughts because I started. Yeah, it's a great movie. I liked hearing what you guys all picked up from it, and it sounds like we're kind of all on the same page with just how exceptionally well made it is. 2006, great year. I think this stands out among other titans of that year. I honestly, Departed won that year. I would have liked to have seen this or even a couple other movies from that year win. Departed is great, but this is one that it's really just excellent from bottom to top. So, yeah, it's... yeah, so final thoughts, good movie.
Yeah, I definitely haven't had too much of a change of heart. Still, I think, you know, I can obviously attest it's just such a well-made movie.
Swallowed a fly.
Yeah, and I mean, I really, really, I will say, talking about it has really made me reflect on how much I liked the fairy tale aspects. Like, every fairy tale scene were the parts when I was really invested, and I was like, this is cool. But the humdrum parts of what's actually going on in the world just never really pulled me in one way or another. The performances, like I said, you know, I think I have a harder time picking up on muted performances to begin with. So when you have everybody's, like, you know, playing very real, grounded, it's just not going to get me too much. But yeah, I would recommend this movie to just about anyone. I mean, it is fantastic. But yeah, I probably won't revisit it, but won't be mad if I do.
This is your first time watching it?
Yeah, this is my first time. I will ask Alex on your final thoughts, if you don't mind. I've never heard you talk about this movie once.
It's a recent one. I watched it 2 years ago.
Okay. Yeah, because I was real. This it did catch me off guard. I was like, I feel like I would have heard him talk about this. But anywho, to you.
Yeah, I love this movie to death. I have absolutely zero flaws or gripes with it. I think everything it does is so driven and well-directed and well-thought-out that, like we all said, it's just such a cohesive movie in that the sound, the visuals, the acting, the score, the effects, everything comes together to just engross you into this world. The reality is brutal and tragic. The fantasy is magical and also tragic. It just invokes so many emotions in you, and that's obviously to the credit of all the performers, the musicians, the director, the set designers, everything. It is just, it's what film is for, right? Like, this story couldn't have been told almost in any other medium. It has the fairy tale storybook aspect of the visuals, but you need the sound design, you need the score, along with it to really sell this story. And it's kind of what makes me love film in general, is movies like this.
Very cool.
Agreed.
Very cool. All right, well, stay tuned, because we're about to hop into The Aviator.
There we go.
Good noise. And welcome back to Keto Clash. We're about to dive into my number 7 seed, The Aviator, and stay tuned for the end because I will be formally resigning from Keto Clash. So it's gonna be lively. Nah, I don't think so. All right, yeah, pretty straight across the board. It's a biopic depicting the early years of legendary director and aviator Howard Hughes. That's okay. That's all you need to know for this one.
Martin Scorsese doesn't make a bad movie. This one just did not speak to me. I don't know. It was, I didn't think the pacing was very good. It was just far too long. I think there was a lot that could have been cut, and it really didn't speak to me until the very end of the movie when Leo's just gone completely insane. I liked that part of the movie quite a bit, but everything up to that was pretty
exhausting. Are you talking
exhausting.
Like post plane crash or post movie theater?
Yeah.
Post plane crash?
Post plane okay. crash when he's naked in his home theater yelling through yeah. the door. That part was quite fun. But yeah, it's just, I don't, and honestly, I didn't think Leo was that good in this. This was not one of my favorite Leo okay. performances. I thought it was quite noticeable. It just felt like Leo doing an accent rather than an actual character. I don't know. It's good. Yeah. There's nothing really inherently bad about it other than the pacing and the runtime, but yeah, it's
this is where I was figuring you would be. Yeah. So I'll...
yeah. This is my second time watching it. The first time we watched it, Kyle, was when we were living together and we were doing that like movie marathon. And that first time I was like, this is okay. I like it. But after watching it again, I really like this movie.
Yay!
I did not feel like 3 hours long like the first time did. I was okay with the pacing because at least there was something going on all the time, and I really like the time period, so maybe there's a little bias there, but I would not place this anywhere near the bottom of Scorsese's list. I really loved Leo as Howard Hughes. He was great in this movie. I saw it more as just an accent. Like he was putting on quite a performance. I think his life is super interesting. Just the bombasticness of it. I got a lot out of this movie. I really, really liked it.
Well, that's nice. Thank you. I thought this was going to be another Kyle name redacted, Kino Clash trademark shit kicking. So it's nice to have at least one person. Well, so I was saving this analogy for final thoughts, but I think I'm going to bring it up here. Because I was thinking on this, I was like, all right, listen, I finished it. The first thing I said when I finished it was, I'm tired of losing. The second thing I said when I finished it was, all right, why do I like this to the degree I do?
Got planes.
I love planes. That literally is part of it. You have fucking airplanes pre-60s? I'm there. But, like, you know, besides the acting, which, Ryan, I think this entire movie is a goddamn acting clinic. I think everybody is killing it.
I don't know. I thought everybody was kind of annoying.
Kate Blanchett.
Hey, love! What you doing? I'm Kate Blanchett in the 1920s.
It's so, I don't know, I just thought it was annoying.
Katharine Hepburn legitimately talked like that. Like, if you listen to her in interviews and stuff, that is, yeah. Kate Blanchett won Best Actress for this, because she fucking killed it.
Yeah, I mean, it's good, it's just, I don't know. It doesn't feel like acting, it just, I don't know, it's weird.
Well, so this was, number one, this is another thing I was like, I'm getting so fucked with these matchups. I'm so goddamn pissed. I could have got Rocketeer. I could have got Rocketeer.
Yeah.
And I got Pan's fucking Labyrinth. this is all to say. So, I was reflecting on it, and but the acting doesn't really even draw me in that much to this movie. Like, it's the reason why I like it so much, but it's not what draws me in. And I think I echo your guys' sentiment I think for the most part, I don't think this is a safe movie, but it certainly doesn't take a single risk. But I don't think that's to the detriment of this film. As I was reflecting on it, I was like, if I just want to watch a really solid movie for me, like, The analogy I would make is that this is to me a really good piece of toast. To you guys, it's a piece of toast. To me, it's a really good piece of toast. I think it just kind of depends on who you are. Because, like, I would recommend this movie to anyone. I don't think it's going to be anyone's favorite, but I don't think anybody's going to watch it and go, wow, I did not like that movie. But yeah, I think just on that merit, like when I am thinking like, all right, you know, because we just fucking watched Hudsucker. I have some very risky movies on my list. But this is, I was looking at how I did it. This is my one movie of like, you know what? I'm not really looking for a real think piece right now or anything. I just want to sit down, take it easy, and watch a really good movie. And to me, this is my best of that kind of movie. This is my, it's 2 a.m., you don't have any food in your house, but you got some bread and some butter, and you put that in the toaster real quick, and you're like, this is the best goddamn piece of toast I have had. But yeah, no, I'm interested. I guess I want to start with Ryan, because truly, the one thing I will disagree with you with is I think the acting in this is just phenomenal. I like, number one, Leo's performance. I can kind of see where you're coming from a little bit, but like, when he's having the OCD scenes, like, I am as tense there as I am in Good Time. And I mean that legitimate. Like, I feel claustrophobic when he is, like, grunting after he does a sentence to try and, like, snap out of it. Like, it's visceral.
Well, that was one of my notes is I thought the OCT, or not OCT, OCD elements were really well portrayed. I thought they really nailed a lot of the camera work on that and everything. Just the in-between stuff. I don't know. I never saw anybody but Leo doing an accent. Now, when he was actually like physically acting and not just delivering lines, that's when his performance was great. And that's why I really resonated with the end of the movie. I thought in those moments when he's really giving a full body performance is when he shined. When he's just delivering lines, I think it could have been anybody. It's like up until the point where he really goes off the rails, I feel like a lot could have been cut. I mean, a lot of it was just treading familiar ground with his issues and his OCD and his problem with spending and everything. It's just like it just kept retreading the same elements over and over. And I don't know. It was kind of a drag to me.
For me, the runtime, like the really long runtime and kind of spending a lot of time on the beginning, like him directing Hell's Angels and kind of stuff that ultimately doesn't have all that many consequences later on in the movie, but kind of allude to certain problems he's having. I think, for me, it had the effect of when I got to the end of the movie, when he's building the Spruce Goose and getting and testifying and really just struggling with OCD, and then they reference Hell's Angels in other parts of the movie, to me it felt like, oh wow, that was so long ago. Like, that was a whole 2 hours ago, that felt like years ago. And I kind of added to the whole thing of like, this movie spans multiple years and its struggles that he has over a long period of time. And so I think the runtime kind of had the added benefit of you feeling the progression of time there and just how distant a lot of things were. And also just how close certain events were, not realizing they were so close. Like with the plane crash and then him getting locked up in his movie theater, like that was way closer in time than I think a lot of us realized, right? Because that was like pretty much one after another in real life, right, Kyle?
Because the plane crash doesn't send him into the theater. It's something else that happens that I can't remember right now. But like the plane crash, like it is. It's very close.
Isn't it the like, show me the blueprints? Show me the blueprints?
Yeah. And you just see him start fracturing. I don't, because I figured the runtime was going to be definitely a big issue. I think this is my second longest movie after The Green Mile. Funny enough, they're right next to each other. After Snyder Cut, thank you. But no, I think that's a really good point, though, Alex, in that I mean, for me, I guess I can see it, like, for y'all, if you're not interested in the character and you're not really interested in the performance until it's really bombastic. There's not a point in this that I'm bored. And I agree that I think if you can get over that hump, then the length really lends to it. And it does exactly what you said, Alex. It lets you get a real grounded sense of time and how things are working.
I don't know. I think it's the fact that it's just retreading the same ideas like an hour later in the film.
But that,
it's
that's
like,
what I'm right, saying.
I,
like,
I saw this an hour ago.
So
I know where this is
going. I think
going.
If you're already not in by that point, I'm there. But like, it doesn't it doesn't matter because I just love watching this person do what they're doing. I don't care that we're going over the same idea. Yeah. I'm like, oh wow, cool. This is fun.
I don't know, because I do like the character, and I thought, yeah, I think there's a really good movie in here for me, but it's just too long. I wouldn't want it shot any other way necessarily. It's just I want less of it. I'd want this to be like 2-2.5 hours max, and I think I would enjoy this a lot more. It's just there's so much fluff to me that is just rehashing the same ideas and going over the same issues and painting this guy the exact same way you've already seen him painted for the entire movie. It's like I never see anything new until the end when he's totally lost it. And that's a big issue for me. It's just I don't think it does enough in between. And if it doesn't have stuff to do differently in between, then it should just cut some of the stuff that it rehashes.
I don't know. When it rehashes things, I think it always does something a little different with whatever it's rehashing. Like, what comes to mind is his relationship with Hepburn, Kate Blanchett, and how, like, you know, they kind of fell in love when she flew for the first time. And they kind of reference, like, oh, take me flying again a few times throughout the movie. But, like, the first time they reference it again, it's like, oh, you know, we're in love. And then that kind of, towards the end when they reference it, it's when he's locked up in his movie theater. And it's just kind of tragic because she's like, I know this man is spiraling and I know I've hurt him by falling for another man, and kind of like, oh yeah, please take me flying again. And it's kind of like appealing to his like child mind there, like his innocence, where he's like, oh yeah, you know, I'm still in love with you and I would love to take you flying again. And kind of retreading a lot of the OCD tropes that this movie has. Each time it either is like, oh man, this guy's losing it, like he's kind of being disrespectful to people he loves, whatever. And then later on, it's like, oh, this is tragic. This man is really struggling with a lot of things. So I think like it's never like really repeating the same theme and the same retreads the same kind of topic in the same exact way. I think it always does something a little different with it. And with everything it does, I think it adds to Howard Hughes' struggle. And I
was going to say, too.
I agree.
Overall, there's also, like, in defense of that first half and of Leo's acting, you know, there's little smidges of mania that you see that kind of get you to where he finally is. I don't even mean, like, the big scenes, like when Jude Law, who's doing a terrific Timothy Dalton performance, by the way. You know, like when he takes the pee off and he's like, all right, I'm done. But like, you know, I think you've said it earlier and it really brought it to my attention this time. Like there's a lot with the eyes in that first scene of like, you can see just fear in this guy. Like the scene that comes to mind is when it's, after he's just broken the speed record, and it's him, Kate Blanchett, and he's going, hey, I'm afraid I'm going to lose my mind one day. And it's probably the most muted performance of the movie, I'd probably say, but no, like there's real fear there that I get.
And along those lines about retreading, and then she responds with, you taught me how to fly, I can go ahead and take the wheel. Like, that was emotionally impactful and kind of retreading the whole thing of like, yeah, we get it. You taught me how to fly. That's fun and all. But I like that. That moment was, yeah, it was very muted, but I think had the biggest emotional impact for me, besides like how sad everything was later on.
I've also, I'm sorry. Did you have something you want to add, Ryan?
No, I agree with you guys. I think it's really effective when they get to those moments. It's just, I don't think you need 3 hours to tell that story. I really don't. I do think it's good, though. Like, those moments that you're talking about, I agree. Like, they are very impactful.
And so, I really did. I got to do a lot of reflecting after this movie. And I think it's been pretty apparent to this point. I respond very well to bombastic performances, as opposed to the more muted ones. But something I really noticed in this is because of that, the voicing of how they're delivering the lines is something like, that's where I think Kate Blanchett shines for me, is not necessarily the voice she's putting on, but like in those really dramatic scenes, she's able to quaver her voice. Like the scene where they're on both sides of the movie theater and like you can hear the breaking in her voice, like that for me was one of those parts as well. And that's why I'm saying, like, I think this is just a really, if you wanted to show someone, hey, here's good acting, throw on The Aviator, because like just really powerful stuff being able to do that while you're talking to a door, no less. You know, like, it, things like that really are like what for me is like, yeah, this, everybody is doing their max. And I mean, that's Scorsese, though.
I would like to talk about some of the, because I mean, honestly, I think I've gotten out my gripes with it. I think most of everything else is things I appreciated about it. The OCD elements, I thought that was great. And there's just a lot of good character interactions and character moments. And I agree, I'm being a little being a little stinker about Cate Blanchett. They're like, the performances are excellent in this, bar Leo. I don't think he's good outside of the physical things. I don't know.
Maybe so that's just before we do jump off completely, of Leo's like physical elements, does everybody have a favorite scene? Because I think there's a few in here that are just like, wow, just stick in my head. Like, there was a Letterboxd review I read going into this, and it was The Aviator plane crash scene is better than the Revenant bear scene, which I agree with completely. when he's in there and he reaches up to the glass, you know, just the first thing you do, and just that guttural scream is, yeah, locked in my head.
My favorite physical performance was when they're talking about the Continental, is that what it's called?
Yeah, the Constellation.
The Constellation. And the guy has like a little smudge on his lapel, and he just stops. Leo just stops in the movie talking, and he goes, "You have a little thing." And just his like looking down at the ground and shooting his eyes back and forth and kind of twitching his hand at his collar, like signifying, like, get that shit off your lapel. I love that performance. It was so just like, he was so incredibly uncomfortable, and you just felt it.
I like when he's, I forget what happened, but he's washing a stain off his clothes in the bathroom, just fervently.
Oh yeah, no, yeah,
manically. I really like that. He's just, I like those old soap dispensers that are like an orb with a pyramid at the bottom, and he's just like fervently smashing it trying to get more soap and scrubbing, and it's, yeah, and he has his own soap and everything. I think that's all very funny. Kind of goes with the OCD elements that I thought were really well done.
Aside from Blanchett, what did y'all think of the supporting cast as well? Because, again, like, one that isn't mentioned much whenever you're reading anything is Adam Scott's performance, but I think he does the best Testament of the Times. He plays the PR guy for Howard Hughes, who interrupts with Errol Flynn during the pee scene. But no, like, him, fucking Alec Baldwin. Love seeing Alec Baldwin in anything.
See, I was going to say, Alec Baldwin I didn't really care about in this movie. He was just kind of, he was the most stale for me. He didn't really do anything with his performance there. And maybe he didn't need to. I have no problem with it, but I don't think he stood out.
I think the only other thing for me, and we'll jump off the acting after this, but this is, I love John C. Reilly in a dramatic role. Sisters Brothers is gonna have him, and that's when I think it's gonna shine. But yeah, I'm really excited to get to see him doing that.
I was doing some counting. I think John C. Reilly is Kino Clash's most prolific actor.
Is he really?
He's in four of our picks. So he's in this, he's in Sisters Brothers, he's in Magnolia, and he's in, of course, Talladega Nights. There might be more if he's like a supporting role, but I thought that was interesting because I was kind of doing some counts. I thought he was tied at like three with a couple other people, Natalie Portman being one of them. But when I saw him in this, which I didn't know he was in, I was like, oh, I think John's got Kino Clash's heart.
I didn't know he was in Magnolia.
Yeah, he's one of the leads.
All right, well, I'm more excited for Magnolia now.
But yeah, I just thought that was interesting. Yeah, no, I thought everybody was pretty good, but I think it's hard to tell with this time period what's a caricature and what's a performance. I just feel like I've seen these characters before, and there's nothing that really differentiates them from any other movie like this. So it's like Cate Blanchett and Leo are the the two standouts, because I think they get a good physical performance as well, whereas everybody else's line delivery, and yeah, even Leo when he's not being physical, I struggle with.
How about the score? I don't think it's anything special. I like some things it does, but
I didn't notice.
I didn't notice it either.
There's just one aspect I really like about it, that they do kind of like the angel versus devil on his shoulder kind of thing, and like when it's uplifting, it's like the da 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 da, and then, you know, there's other scenes where he's burning all his clothes in his courtyard, and it's just this like all the horns coming in, and like, oh, this guy's downtrodden.
Good enough for me, I suppose.
I didn't move on. So one thing I will say though, not as a testament to the score, but testament to the lack thereof, the way this movie makes uncomfortable silences is also one of those that makes me just feel very claustrophobic. When it's in the beginning of the movie and it's the Hepburn sequence and he's at the family dinner table with them. That's one I'm kind of surprised, Ryan, that you couldn't latch on to Leo's acting, actually, because, like, that's one where I'm like, oh, I'm so uncomfortable right now. My skin feels like it's crawling.
Yeah, I don't know. It's kind of like the whole talk over everybody kind of thing, and it's claustrophobic and everything, but he's not doing anything crazy there, I don't feel like. And I don't, well, what pauses are you talking about? Because there's no silence in that scene.
Oh, hell yeah, there is.
I didn't notice like moments of silence throughout this movie, and that scene specifically was super loud and convoluted. So what are you talking about?
It's, yeah. So it's loud and convoluted, except when Katharine Hepburn shifts the spotlight back onto Howard Hughes, and anytime it's like, oh, Howard, tell him about your plane, and everybody stops talking, and it's silent, and then he takes like 5 seconds to get going, and it's like, and then all the cacophony breaks back out.
Yeah, I did like that scene quite a bit, but I feel like that's kind of, and it was in Whiplash too, just that thing of people don't appreciate the work that you're doing, and don't see it as the kind of art that he sees it as. Also, the scene kind of speaks to how he's using his money versus how he perceives them to be misusing their money. They're basically not doing anything with it. Even though he's always had this money, he feels like he is righteous in the fact that he's always been doing something to push humanity forward with it, while he perceives them as just kind of sitting on their ass with it.
So I meant to look up the history for this. I did not. Is he, because he makes multiple references this movie that he was not born with a silver spoon in his mouth, but it absolutely looks like he was.
Yeah, his parents own like drill bit company, right? Toolco.
Yeah, right? But like he says at the Hepburns, it's a line that I love when they go, oh, we don't care about money here, Mr. Hughes. And he goes, well, that's because you've always had it. And
yeah,
that sitting there, it's like
off, because I'm like, you literally come for money too. Yeah.
Sir, you were born on a 3-acre farm.
Well, that's another reason I really like this movie so much, is because, well, number one, I think there's a lot of Kane in Leo's performance here, or at least in the character they've created of like, no, I'm the savior of the people. I'm going to give them the freedom they've so desperately wanted, kind of deal. Even though it's like, no, you're just like, you're also just rich.
Yeah. An Elon Musk of his time.
An Elon Musk.
I was gonna say, I didn't want to make the reference, but you see a lot of Elon Musk, or you see a lot of Howard Hughes and Elon Musk, and
yeah.
I mean, Musk is literally the modern day Howard Hughes.
Yeah. Because I was drawing those comparisons. I was like, oh yeah, I know this kind of guy. I know what Howard Hughes is like.
I've seen this fella.
Yeah. I'm sure that's probably a common thing of just somebody with so much money and brains to do something with it. I guess that kind of leads you to believe you can give people something.
I mean, I guess there's kind of like he sees himself as the outsider, because he says multiple times he hates Juan Trip. I've been fighting these, like, basically I've been fighting these Harvard motherfuckers my whole life. So I don't know. I am interested what they were going for there with the why he has this crusade against.
I mean,
I think what Howard Hughes is going for in this movie, or maybe in real life, is that he's criticizing people who come for money and do nothing with it, just kind of swim in money, whereas he is like constantly trying to, like, in his mind at least, progress the world and benefit the world with his money and create something new and novel and interesting to benefit society. And oftentimes, like, no one's ever helping him out and everyone's trying to take him down. So he's always doing it out of his own pocket. And so he uses his money literally as a tool. And that's why he criticizes people who just do nothing with their money and just are gluttonous and lustful. And
yeah.
I would definitely say they use kind of the lie that he is, hasn't had money to, yeah, kind of just flesh out his character and show him as somebody who maybe sees himself differently than others do, and show some of his flaws, I would say.
I think his criticism of people, even though you come from money, that criticism is that even though he has a ton of money, he still has a ton of money problems, because he's always tight for money.
You don't get it. You're prudent with your cash. I am bleeding.
I can barely afford a jet right now.
I'll bet you trust banks, you crazy person.
Yeah, it was definitely fun seeing Howard Hughes, though, because that's somebody that I knew pretty much nothing about. I'd heard of Hell's Angels. I didn't realize the affiliation and kind of the mania that went into making that movie. So that was interesting. I looked that up on Letterboxd after I'd heard about it. And it's kind of cool that he did all these things. So I think the movie does a good job of showing kind of the more bombastic elements of his career, I guess. I think I could have enjoyed more just reading about Howard Hughes until the end. I think the editing at the end felt totally different than the rest of it. Like, it felt snappy. It felt quick. Like in the law, courthouse, I guess, going back and forth between Leo and the head prosecutor. Just that whole interaction, I thought that was by far the most snappy, interesting. Like, it had a pulse. Like everything else, it was just kind of like a journey telling you what happened. This one felt like a presentation of his life, a presentation of that moment in time. And I think that fit the best visually. And I think the rest of the movie could have done that, but it just didn't. I don't know.
Yeah, along those lines, I didn't notice a problem with the editing until we talked about it now, and now thinking about it and talking over it. Yeah, it was very traditional editing until the end. And honestly, in the middle, there's this one random
best
part.
Editing, by the way.
Just did it really?
Throw it out that it did. So, and so did Bohemian Rhapsody. They clearly don't really give a lot of shit about. What did we say it on the last recording? Of like, a lot of the times it wins because it has the most editing.
The one editing part that stood out to me, and I wish either they didn't include it at all because it felt out of place, or they leaned into it more, was when he's burning his clothes and he's calling John C. Reilly, and they have like both their faces transposed on the screen, and Leonardo DiCaprio's like fiery in the background and John C. Reilly's asleep. That part was interesting and cool and fun, but like nothing else in the movie was like that.
Yeah.
So no, either they do take that. It out completely. They do that a couple more times.
Yeah, they do the same thing a couple of times.
Like, oh, really?
Which that part? Kind of,
yeah, he's
there's a few phone calls.
When he's in the theater and Alec Baldwin's on the outside, they do that same transpose.
That's true.
Yeah. That was actually one of the... I don't care for that at all. I think it's a little cheesy.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just, if they would have done...
Are you telling me 2004 CGI airplanes don't do it for you?
I was not a fan of that. That looked kind of bad. that opening sequence. It kind of looked like Revenge of the Sith opening sequence, except
Yeah, but like this know. Was
so quick,
like as good as you could get in 2004, and then you could argue, okay, well then it doesn't look that good, so don't include it. But you really couldn't tell the story of these gigantic planes without CG. You can't crash the plane into a house like that. I mean, I guess if you don't have a pilot, but also the Spruce Goose, like you can't rebuild that.
You can't rebuild the Spruce Goose. It's right, but the Hercules, God damn it!
Put some respect on it, Alex. yeah, I don't know. That was very minor. I think I took less issue with that.
It's like the only thing I'm on here that's like, yeah, it's a negative. But like, also, I feel like the visual of this movie is kind of, it's got like a hint of cartoony-ish to it to begin with. So like the CGI kind of fits. I don't know how you guys felt about the visuals also. I think these are some of just the most immaculate sets I've seen. Like, I really like every set piece they use. Once it finished, I was thinking about it. I think Scorsese might have been going for a bit of, like, Mask of the Red Death vibe, because each room has a set color. And, like, what I was noticing is whenever Leo is in, like, a red room, like, when he comes back from flying with Kate Blanchett, he's in a red room, and he says, I hate this room. I don't know why my interior decorator did it this way. But, like, the Coconut Grove is always blue. He's always happiest when he's in the sky being surrounded by blue. My personal headcanon, I thought that was kind of an interesting thing.
I didn't catch that, but I believe it and appreciate it.
We got any other highlights there, everybody, or ready to start closing out?
I can't wait to watch Planes.
Yeah, whose pick was that again?
I think that's number two, if I'm not mistaken.
It's my number two pick.
His number one pick is Planes 2.
It's Cars.
Yeah, what are the aviation? So obviously, Great Waldo Pepper. But I was thinking about, Rocketeer. Too, we watch more.
The Rocketeer.
Rocketeer,
yeah.
And this, I guess it's three. But I mean, that's like very nearly 10% in hindsight, right? Three out of... Oh, wait, no, never mind.
Do we consider First Man about like the Apollo program?
Aviation? Oh, First Man 100% is.
All right, we got First Man. Anyway.
You boys like your planes.
I like my
we
space.
Like planes. Planes are cool. Like this era of planes. Today's planes suck. Today's planes are garbage and boring. They just look like triangles.
Kyle, I'm going to get you the 3 DVD collection, Lots and Lots of Planes, for your birthday.
Oh my god, you touched a part of my memory that did not exist.
Oh, Lots and Lots of Trains, that's for babies. Lots and Lots of Planes, that's a men's watch.
You just poked a nerve.
Yeah, no, I have nothing else, though.
I'm good for closing thoughts, then. We want to.
This was my first time watching it. I've seen a lot of other Scorsese movies, and I this one is probably my least favorite out of his like better known films. But it was still good, and I think that speaks to his competence as a director. I think he's never going to make a bad movie, at least not that I've seen. And this one, it really the main issue is because there was a lot to latch onto that I thought was great, but the pacing in the runtime was kind of an issue for me. I don't feel like it really lended itself to the plot because it kept rehashing the same ideas and everything, and that's I don't know. I just kind of found it uninteresting after it came up again and again. And the ending kind of it really bumped it up for me. I would have liked this movie a lot less if it didn't end the way that it did, and I think it did a lot of really interesting portrayals of his OCD and his character and everything. So yeah, a lot to like about it. Not my favorite Scorsese, obviously, but yeah, it was still good. There's nothing bad about it, really, just things that don't mesh with me personally.
I'm the opposite. I put this in my top three Scorsese movies after this rewatch. I really liked a ton of it. It was a very, I think, traditionally made biopic. I do agree that it really didn't take all that many risks, and it could have told this story in a more interesting visual way, storytelling way. But I may be a little biased, but I do really like this time period, and early aviation is just such a cool part of history. And I just I'm fascinated by time periods where they're just really on the bleeding edge of technology and taking everything to the extreme. Like the Hercules, only up until recently, has still been the largest plane ever flown.
Oh, has it officially been beat?
Yeah, there's another company, Stratolaunch, that's a plane called Rock. It's not as bulky as Hercules, but has a longer wingspan. But, yeah, it's supposed to launch rockets out of the sky, so it's kind of cool. But anyway, so, like, that and the way he filmed Hell's Angels and that, like, you literally could not make a movie like that post-1950, probably, just how freaking dangerous and crazy that movie was to make. So that kind of stuff is just, like, that's so fascinating to see parts of our history that are like that. And he really was, like... And I do like the character of Howard Hughes. He was truly like a visionary and had such a clear vision of doing things and would not budge until things were done exactly the way he envisioned it. So the story itself, I was super fascinated by it. And that obviously elevated the movie for me. But I think overall, acting was great. The directing was as good as it needed to be. It's just a solid movie.
And yeah, I think that's a pretty good jumping off point for me is it basically what I said at the top, everything Alex just said. I think this is, again, just you slam your fist on this table of a movie and you're like, that is a solid movie. That is well built. And then from there, it just kind of depends on the person, I think. Because like, yeah, I'm infatuated with this time period. I halfway speak like I'm from it.
20 years prior. I think you're more 1920s prohibition era. Yeah, but.
but no, I'm fascinated with this person. I love aviation. So, like, you know, again, it depends on what you put on your piece of toast. If this is what you like, then yeah. It's my number 7 movie, right? So, like, It's not a sushi dinner. It's not gonna get to that caliber. But again, it's if I'm looking for, I just want to watch a movie. This is what I'm putting on. Let's get into voting.
All right. I guess Alex should vote first, and then Kyle. And then...
No, actually, I'm gonna vote first. Just makes sense. That way, we'll get mine out of the way. Yeah, I'm voting for The Aviator. I'm also about to lose. I think everyone's going to pick Pan's Labyrinth. And yeah, obviously, I can't blame you for it. For me, I'll talk more about Pan's here. Pan's is a weird movie, I think. That's not a bad thing. I love really weird movies, but that's kind of what the metaphor I was kind of going with there. Not everybody's going to like a weird movie. You know, it's going to be very hit or miss. You're either going to really like it or you won't. And for me, Pan's was a miss for the most part. Like, everything it did was great, but it just didn't resonate with me, didn't grab me at all. You know, I haven't thought about it since I watched it. Whereas The Aviator, for me, you know, I'm just happy. I love Leonardo DiCaprio, and I love the 1940s, and I love aviation. So, yeah, I mean... That being said, I'm not mad about this one, but yeah, I'll be voting for The Aviator.
Kyle, is mental deterioration a Nazi or gravity?
Okay, now that's interesting, and I am going to take at least 1 minute on this one. I'm probably going to go gravity. You know, you're bound down. Howard Hughes is trying to fight his way off the Earth by constantly grabbing for more sky, and he knows that he is going to die, and he can't, no matter how much money and brains he has, he is human, and he is still affected by gravity. So yes, mental deterioration, gravity is the villain.
Okay, maybe I'm slow on this, is obvious, but I just realized that whole Nazi and gravity being the only two villains, all I was really saying is it's either man or nature, right? Like, just boil it down to that. And that's just an obvious statement, is it not?
This is a movie.
Yeah. Weird conflict.
Prove me wrong.
Oh, boy. Okay. So these were both two very solid movies. I think they were, of the matchups, I think they were two most high-quality movies, at least in my opinion, that we matched up together. And while they're both really solid, Pan's Labyrinth just puts it over the edge for me because it's solid, and it takes risks, and it's super creative and imaginative, and it does a lot that I've never seen before, and it sticks around a lot. My biggest appeal to The Aviator, honestly, is the story and the character, but I don't know how much you can attribute that to the movie because it is literally just based on true events. So while I applaud Martin Scorsese for making a good movie around an interesting story, you know, it's not original, obviously. So I don't know how much I can attribute it to the movie versus Pan's Labyrinth. It's such an original, creative movie and is so expertly crafted in everything that it does. I mean, it's almost a no-brainer for me. Pan's Labyrinth is definitely my pick.
Pan's Labyrinth is also going to be my vote. There's a lot of filmmaking elements that I really latch onto in Pan's Labyrinth. And while the Aviator is a very well-made, solid movie, it's just it failed to captivate me until pretty much the end. I think there was plenty to not include in that would have given me a better experience. And that's obviously very subjective, but yeah, it's just the story was not nearly as interesting as Pan's Labyrinth to me, so I've got to stick with that one.
It didn't Leonardo decaptivate you?
Not quite.
Come on, Kyle, you like those word plays. Come on.
Every now and again.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, on the 6th of March, 2022, Pan's Labyrinth has moved forward, and I am now 1-5. And you know what? I'm okay with that.
You just got to pick up your long epic sickle and slash us down.
More importantly, though, I think Alex is breaking even.
Alex has had quite the resurgence.
You are on 3 in a row right now. Are you not?
I think so. I'm 3-3, right?
Yeah.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, you have won your last 3.
Have you been in the last 3?
No, we had our Inside Llewyn Davis Leon break.
3 of the last 4. Right, okay.
Yeah. So yeah, we've got Alex in second place, Ryan with a commanding lead on first, and Brendan third, and me in a firm 4th. So,
but that's the thing, though. We got to see if any run deep. I might be sitting on I might have a castle of sand here.
Ooh. I mean, that is, yeah, no, it's, I don't think you do, but no, there are some that could run deep. There's some interesting ones on here. All right, I guess roll it.
Yeah, we're getting down to the ones that I'm really excited about. Like, really excited about.
Speed Jobs, right. Still on the table.
Speed Jobs. Fingers crossed, everybody. All right, I'm going to roll. This is 1-19. And we have...
I think this is the shittiest matchup I got. I'm really upset about this one. No. This is my 4 seed, the Sisters Brothers, versus Ryan's 13 seed, the City of God.
Okay. Back-to-back John C.
Back-to-back John C. Okay.
Keep your head up, Chance.
Have you guys seen both?
I've seen the Sisters Brothers.
I've seen both. Dude. Sisters Brothers has a fighting chance. I mean, that's a great movie right there.
I do think it has a fighting chance, but I cannot tie. I cannot tie. I have to win you both over, and I don't think I can do that. Because City of God's fucking fantastic. It's so good.
Yeah, I like both of them quite a bit. So I guess City of God is first then.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
Okay. This is... Oh, it's going to be a hard one, but I'm going to try my goddamn best.
Very good. Yeah, this is not one that I was like super looking forward to, just because I've seen them both. I want to see something new. Something new and weird.
You've had a couple of new weeks of new movies for you.
Yeah. You know? Like I think I've seen a lot of like half of them kind of thing.
Yeah, Ryan, what's the best new movie you've seen? Because I think you've kind of not really liked all the new movies you've seen.
Like the movies I've seen for the first time?
Yeah, in this podcast.
I liked Smoke Signals quite a bit. I'd have to look at the list. Give me a second to pull that up.
Yeah, okay. This is actually a good little segment, though. I like that. What is everybody's favorite new movie they've seen?
Mine's Old Boy.
Brendan's had a couple that were surprises to me. Push, I didn't think it was that good, but I liked it a lot. it's a fun time.
Old Boy, a good time for me. Kyle, what about you?
It's still Donnie Darko. Yeah, been thinking about that one a lot.
Yeah, as far as the ones I haven't seen, I'm looking forward to Speed Jobs, and I'm looking forward to Shin Godzilla quite a bit. That's one I've wanted to see for ages. Just haven't gotten to it, so. Well, everybody, we'll see you next time with the City of God versus the Sisters Brothers discussion. It's going to be a good one. You don't want to miss it, so mark your calendars for 2 weeks from right now. Make it urgent. Mark your calendar as busy. Set on Do Not Disturb, you know, all those good things, because Kino Clash demands your Kino Clash demands your full attention. Yeah, outgoing, watching Kino Clash, BRB. thank you, everybody. Bye-bye. So long.